Before I get going, I just want to say thank you very much to PHM, Annelien and Tinashe in particular for hosting this. Just as a way of introduction, a number of us have been meeting as part of the C19 People's Coalition Health Group. And it's been a really great experience in terms of getting together as different comrades in South Africa working in public health and human rights. And in particular, we have a focal group dealing with sexual and reproductive justice. And this is really important because often in South Africa, we have seen a vertical lens in addressing issues, you know, either dealing with HIV or dealing with a particular illness and not seeing the whole complete person. And it's really good, and perhaps for the first time, that we've seen such a close working together across sectors, embracing a whole range of issues. Now, I just want to go back to the concept of sexual and reproductive justice and acknowledge Loretta Ross, who conceptualized this concept with colleagues in 1994. And this concept framework takes the concept of reproductive health and rights further by looking at the options of people to choose to have children or choose not to have children. And you'll notice within our framing, we have folks here within our working group who are sex workers, who are queer folks, and who are providers as well of health services. And coming out of South Africa, we have a history, a legacy of population control, and also a clear enforcement of who should have children, who's believed they should have children, and who should not have children. And so I think that this is incredibly important as one looks at the opportunities we have in taking this concept forward and domesticating this in South Africa and in the region. I'm going to ask folks, just in terms of our engagement, I think to mute your mic and to turn off your video, just so that we can save bandwidth. We're going to start off with speakers presenting and talking a little bit about their experience, and then we're going to have a time of questioning and discussion. And then after that, Sister Judy will close up for us. But I also would encourage folks, if you want to start listing any questions or things that you're interested in the chat box. And so that when we do come to the time to talk amongst each other, those have been outlined. But also, if I could say very, very clearly and underscore that we are hosting a brave space. This is a space where we are informed by the concept of sexual and reproductive justice. And as comrades together, we support the rights of people to have access to services, to either have children or choose not to have children. We support the rights of sex workers, and how they articulate their needs. And also, we support folks of all sexual orientations and gender identities. And we're also very, very grateful to have health providers with us, two folks from the coalface after 4 o'clock, after a full day's work. So without taking up any more time, I'm going to hand over first to Comrade Dudu from SWET. To tell us about how her work has been affected and issues affecting sex workers.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Marianne, and thank you for C119 to give us an opportunity. I will start sharing what sex workers are going through during this time of COVID-19 since lockdown. This lockdown affects sex workers a lot in terms of, as we know, that sex work in South Africa is criminalized, and They were not, even government, when they announcing all the relief that it's taken out there, sex workers was not mentioned, and they didn't put either of the relief funds that can sex workers benefit on. It's affecting sex workers because they're making money to make a living and put food on the table. So it affects sex workers financial. There was a lot of the changing in their lifestyle because of sex workers are breadwinners, sex workers are mothers, sex workers, some of the sex workers, they're moving from another province to another province, and they are renting their houses. Some of the sex workers are working in brothels. So there was a lot of changing lifestyles of sex workers. It was too much challenging in financial for them. It's also damaging for them, the ways of living in this country in terms of health. Also, they were affected because some of the sex workers, they couldn't able to go to fetch their medication, do that. Some they use transport money, and the system of the way that the system was eating during the lockdown was too full and not able to make sex workers access treatment. And some of the sex workers are staying homeless. They've been removed from the street to put in different places where they were stigmatized, and there was a lot that was happening the lockdown and the COVID-19. It was a disaster, but I find that government was supposed to should be putting place also to include sex workers, like each workers and business in South Africa. Sex workers, even now, we're doing collecting some of this of their experiences. We find that even in their mentally, they are very disturbed. They are not coping. They are struggling to put food on the table for their children because they're not making any money. They need some services that they need. They need support, but there is no any structure without Sweat and Mothers for the Future and Sisonke on the structure that it's only looking for sex workers without any resources in terms of financial. We're not able to support them financially. There is a lot that is happening. Sex workers, some of the sex workers, they were kicking out by their landlords, and they're not able to go to shelters. Shelters, they were full. And some of the sex workers, we have to ask their friends to keep them, but you cannot place the sex worker to the friends without food. We need to put food for them. And some of the sex workers, they were pregnant. They do not know. Most of the sex workers, they were panicking. Sex workers, they were giving birth. Some, they didn't have even plan to buy some clothes for children. And also they couldn't able to contact their families, those they couldn't move, so there was very limited of movement to sex workers. There was lots, and there was lots of gender-based violence that sex workers they were experienced during the lockdown from the police, from the metro police, and also not only from that, but also they experiencing the changes, those sex workers who staying in the community, because they normally not ask from the neighbors, but they were supposed now to ask from the neighbors, to ask things that they need, also their families, to ask from the families. And there is a lot of changing in their situation in terms of their relationships. There is a lot that is affecting sex workers because they were really, I'm not saying that they were not ready, but everyone was not ready. But I think that government make a big mistake on when they not even to put them in the plan. What I can say for now, COVID-19, I'll call it destroying so many lives of sex workers. In the moment.
Thanks very much, Dudu. Can you please maybe just tell us a little bit more about SWET and how folks can support you and act in solidarity? Do you have any on your website, do you have any materials for people to have a look at, donation points?
Yes. Oh, so during this COVID-19, because of we didn't have a financial that we can support sex workers, food parcel, so we come up with backer bodies where people they can donate there, and then we use those resources to support sex workers, and we depend on it. We don't have yet. Beside Tekano, that also support M4F, Mothers for the Future, to support in terms humanitarian funds that you can support. But now what I can ask is that go to the SWET website. That is, they have a call it www.sweat.za. So you can go there, and then there's a backer bodies, and please share as much as you can, so that people can donate on it. Then those funds are using direct to help sex workers during this time of the disaster. And we have M4F, call it a quick hat, and you can go to www.quickhat.co.za, where you donate for mothers. You can donate anything from there. It's not easy for people to drop stuff in different places, but you can donate, and then we use those funds also to support mothers and children to put something on the food or on the table for them.
Sorry to interrupt, Dudu, but I'm just noticing we've got 48 participants, and I'm really excited to see we've got folks, colleagues from Ghana, from Kenya, and we've got Marlene Gerber-Fried from Boston, who introduced me to the concept of reproductive justice. Lovely to have you, Marlene. I want to just ask if you can explain to people who the mothers are. Nicaragua, we've got somebody. Can you please explain what Mothers for the Future are and how you organize, just very briefly, and then I'm going to hand over to Sharon. I understand this is a way of sex workers who are mothers who organize. Just tell us a little bit more, please.
Okay. Mothers for the Future, it was started on 2013 after we've done a survey in four provinces. We were looking at specific that what is the need of a sex worker as a mother. Then we were looking at the motherhood. We're working direct with mothers who are doing sex work and plus their children. But also Mothers for the Future, it's more specific on looking at, I am not a sex worker and it ends there. And I'm not a carrier of or a focus on HIV, but we were very broader into looking at where sexual reproductive health, education for children of sex workers, children that are affected by HIV for sex workers. Also looking at how can we able to support our children, and looking at PMCT, mental, all those things that Mothers for the Future are focusing that. But it's the most focusing on motherhood as a sex worker. So we've grown until we have like 40, we have in four provinces properly where we function, and all these provinces is Johannesburg, Durban, and East London, Western Cape. We create really a safe space where specific that space, it's not look like creative space, but it's a space where the mothers taking a lead and facilitate by themselves, sharing their experiences and their need. But the space, it's more relaxed in terms of talking about the issues of their children, that's what they face during the growing and what the support they need for their children, and also increasing the love between and bonding between the mother and the child, because people, they also believe that sex workers and also they do not understand that and not knowing that sex workers are mothers. So we will want to highlight and do the awareness to say, I'm a best mom, I sacrifice for my children. So it, Mother for the Future is very broad, but also we're looking at, we also support full decriminalization and looking at what criminalization affects our children. In two provinces, we already look, having two houses where children of sex workers are kept and keeping, we're starting safe houses for children of sex workers. The purpose of those houses that we were fighting that sex workers, most of mothers, they were, their children are taking away because they think that are not best mothers or are not fit to be mothers. So they remove their children from them. So now we're looking at that to say, no, we love our children even due circumstances, but we don't want to be separated by with our children. And we love our children to know that what we're doing, we're doing for them. So that's why we're having those two houses. Then we have houses that have 14 of children of sex workers, and Johannesburg is 10 for now, and its numbers are increasing. And hopefully, if people can able to support those houses, for now we are renting those houses.
Great, thank you so much, Dudu, and I really do think Mothers for the Future is an absolute model of reproductive justice in affirming sex workers to be mothers or parents if they want to. And also to choose not to, and guiding them through healthcare options. I'm going to hand over now to Sharon from Triangle.
Hi, everybody. It's wonderful to see so many people on the call, and as Marion highlighted, being part of the C19 Health Coalition, and then, of course, our sub-working group. So a Triangle Project is an LGBTIQ plus social justice organization with various program areas, my program areas, the health program area. We relate very much with what Sister Dudu has been saying, and I'm sure that many others who are on this call have experienced the same thing. So the challenges that Triangle faced in the work that we did, particularly in the health program, which was where the main response was coming from initially, was the, and I don't think any of us, wherever we are in the world, could have anticipated the impact that COVID would have on the people that we serve. So we thought we had things pretty much in place, permits in place to be able to continue providing services and doing the work. What we couldn't have predicted was how long this would go on for and the massive demand. So the greatest demand has been on nutrition, on therapeutic services, so on counseling, and therapy. On medical interventions, on interventions around gender-based violence, a small minority of it interpartner violence, but mainly on people who were locked down for long periods of time with family members who were either homophobic or transphobic, and in several cases had to remove people along with the gender-based violence command center to emergency accommodation. Those who struggled with addictions, with substance abuse, it was highly problematic. Many who we serve are people who perhaps have a collision of intersections existing in one person, and I'm well aware that we all do, but I think when we look at things like somebody may be transgender, black, unhomed, a sex worker, there's all sorts of vulnerabilities there. And the most high risk group people and those most vulnerable are also often those at most in most need of care, and those that are least likely to seek care because of all the barriers that we know to healthcare. So we found certainly in the initial phases of COVID that the hospitals, the day clinics, the response was very much geared towards COVID and not taking that much notice of things like adherence to medication, underlying conditions, as COVID went along and as we learned more and as we knew more, so things started to change. But Dudu also alluded to the camps that unhoused people were removed to in the initial phases. And then it becomes very difficult for organizations like Triangle, who are service organizations, to be able to continue to track patients because people were being, not patients, people. People were being moved around from place to place and it was becoming very difficult to maintain contact. That has happened for us throughout the COVID pandemic with clients, and I want to highlight particular older clients in our case who were moved from, for example, isolation facilities into hospitals, into field hospitals. So you're moving people around the COVID system who also have other underlying issues, and it makes it really difficult to track and trace people. The last thing, well, I also want to highlight another thing that Dudu says, and I think one can then begin to see how many marginalized communities have similar challenges and for similar reasons. So at Triangle Project, our constituents and people that we serve are not all in one place. Some people are across the province, spread widely across the province, also up in the Northern Cape and the Southern Cape. So it was, how do we provide the level of services that we need to all of those who access our services throughout this period? And that means all of our services, nutrition, counseling. So gave us what we needed was to bring on more people. We needed to bring on board those people that we had trained as community care workers to provide care. In some cases, it was palliative care, end-of-life care, care in the homes. In some cases, it was needing additional Xhosa and Zulu-speaking therapists, which we managed to bring online so that we could cover it. And then how did we provide very concrete things like nutrition to our groups in rural areas? And then the last thing I want to say in terms of appreciation and understanding the challenges faced is that, and I think this very much speaks to what Dudu was saying, is that conventional means of support that exist for heterosexual persons and cisgender persons even, but families and churches and other kind of structures that would be supportive of people generally in society are often not there for LGBTI people, for sex workers, and SWET and Triangle share, many clients use both of the services. So those conventional structures of support that would be there in a very heteronormative society are not in existence often for LGBTI people. And I just want to end by saying, because I know some people are on the call, but I think Marion also spoke to this. This has been one of the great things for us over this time, is the partnerships that we forged. In some cases, they may seem unconventional, but we have so valued, the SRJC, which we are part of, Sister Judy Renape, who will do the close, who's been unbelievably helpful. Certain people in the Department of Health, and Doctors Without Borders, who have assisted with training some of our peer educators and community care workers, and just the solidarity amongst organizations and individuals within the health system has been amazing, and we thank you very much for that. Thank you.
Thanks, Sharon. And Sharon, could you also let us know, do you have a website that you can drop in the box? Do you have any fundraising options?
Yes. So I will
tell us about that a bit.
Yes. So
I will hand over to Khaladi.
Yeah, so I'll put that in the box. We have a campaign called Unlocking Love During Lockdown. And the reason is for all the reasons I've told you, that everything has increased exponentially. So when, for example, in usual times, because none of these services are unique to COVID for Triangle, these are services that we're always offered. So we've always had a nutrition program, for example. But whereas we had funding monthly to reach 100 people in the nutrition program, we are now reaching upward of 500 a month. So it wasn't something that we were ever prepared for or prepared to go on this length of time for. So we have Unlocking Love During Lockdown, and I will put that in the chat box. And I will also encourage people to go on to Triangle's Facebook page. We post regularly on there. Thank you very much for that, Marion.
Thanks so much, Sharon. If folks are able to, if they want to, you can start dropping questions into the chat box. I understand that Khaladi is struggling to get connectivity. Are you on, Khaladi? Yes, fantastic. Welcome to you from Rustenburg. Please tell us how you're doing.
Yes, I'm on now, finally.
Welcome. It's fantastic to have you after a full day's work as a clinical provider. Thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you for inviting me, Marion.
So, Khaladi, perhaps you can answer the questions that we can ask. You know, so how has COVID affected your work and your peers in Rustenburg? What have been your greatest challenges? What would you like those that are here attending to understand about the conditions in what you work and to appreciate about the kinds of things that you come up against? So maybe if you could just speak to those questions, please.
Okay, yeah, thank you, yeah. So yeah, thanks for the opportunity, Marina. I think since the lockdown has started with our activities, especially around safe abortion services and family planning, from actually the beginning, where we noted that when the lockdown started, where facilities were being not really closed, there were decongesting facilities, where especially in the hospitals around, where elective procedures were being cancelled by the doctors, and then in some of the facilities where they saw safe termination of pregnancy as elective procedures, and then were being cancelled. There was about 2 to 3 weeks where it was cancelled, where because second trimesters especially were seen as elective procedures because it was done in the hospital and with the plan of decongesting the hospital and having beds available for COVID patients. That's one of the first challenges that we came across with during the lockdown. And we managed to go back to those facilities, and then we discussed with the management of the facilities, you know, about the importance of safe abortion and also access to safe abortion care for our patients that actually come to the facilities. And eventually we managed to speak with the facility managers, and then finally they said, okay, no, we can, safe abortion was allowed again. And the most recent one that we've been coming across, especially the past month, where we had providers that tested positive for COVID, and having it, especially from how many facilities, it was three facilities, and each facility has one provider. And those providers unfortunately tested positive for COVID, and then we were in a situation that all the services had to come to a standstill in those facilities. And we had, in the past week, because I was actually booking the patients, we had about 40 women that needed second trimester to be done from all the facilities which we were booking. And then this past week we had to, myself and the doctor that we work with, actually had to book all 40 of those patients for this week for the procedures to be done. Because if it went by, we knew that, you know what, if we let it wait for another 2-3 weeks, that they will eventually go over 20 weeks and we will not be able to help them. And The other thing that we found that is a challenge, especially the now with the implementing of social distancing within the facilities. In one of our clinics, we were able to do about 20 procedures at 20 first trimester, let's say 15 first trimesters and 5 second trimesters a daily. So with the restrictions that were implemented, obviously with social distancing and number of people allowed in a facility, we had to drop it down to 6 procedures that we can do a day. And that led to a backlog. Like even now till this day, we've got a backlog of patients that are in need of the service. So the best, what we currently doing now is basically we make sure if a woman is coming to request safe abortion care, that minimum at least that an ultrasound is done. And then obviously if they're above 9 weeks, we book them for a day. But what most challenging is that most of the women, they come expect with expectation that the abortion will be done on the same day. And some we have to book. The furthest one which we booked today, it's I think it's the second week of September. See with the number of people that are coming requesting. So yeah, those are the challenges that we've been facing. And then we're also trying to implement self-managed abortions up to 12 weeks. And we've been in discussions with the National Department of Health on having self-managed abortions in the facilities up to 12 weeks. But that also has been, it's ongoing discussions. We haven't really won that battle as yet. But that's one thing that we're planning to implement, that, you know, facilities should have self-managed abortions, even at primary healthcare level, healthcare professionals can give a medical abortion up to 12 weeks. So yeah, that's what has been happening in around the Northwest, and we've been involved in. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your insights, Khaladi. Sister Judy, it's great to know that you've been on since the beginning. How have things been for you? And I know that you've been absolutely central to being a provider and a point of contact to folks in Triangle and folks in SWET, and a huge resource as a provider to the SRJC. Can you let us know how things are going as somebody in the coalface in the Western Cape? Thank you, Judy.
Hi, everyone, and thank you so much for this opportunity and for everyone who's actually joined. I can just say that this has actually been the worst time of my nursing career, the COVID-19, because so many changes has actually happened. Our programs actually had to come to a standstill. Okay, to all those that don't know me, I'm a professional nurse. I'm a nurse trainer for the Department of Health in the Western Cape. And I'm also an abortion provider and also mentor people that are doing providing abortion services. So because COVID-19 had to be prioritized, we've actually had to stop all our programs with regard to sexual reproductive health services and abortion services. So most of our services, like Khaladi had said, we also had to decant our facilities because we couldn't allow people to come to the facilities. And the biggest challenge was the messaging that went through to the public that they should actually stay at home was actually the most damaging part, because then women were not accessing the services because it was said that you only access the service when you're feeling sick. And this message was actually communicated throughout everybody in such a way that women were actually turned down in some of our facilities by the gate already, by the security. So it was actually a challenge. So it was us having to prioritize on COVID. It was actually double work for us because we would be doing work with COVID into screening and testing, and also trying to make sure that whichever women that were actually brave enough or that could actually access our services would actually gain access into our facility. So that was actually a challenge. And it was actually sad for people that probably didn't know anybody within the system, you wouldn't be able to, for example, contact me and say, Sister Judy, I'm standing outside, I can't go in, for me to actually communicate with the people inside. So that was actually a big challenge. And I'm not sure if I could say, because the department was so overwhelmed with COVID because it's new and everything, it was only realized halfway when we were, like, for example, in April already, that the data for child health and maternal health was actually down. And then only it was communicated that, oopsie, we need people to actually bring in their children for immunizations. We need to tell the women out there to actually come in for their contraceptive methods, and they should actually access any abortion services or SRH services that they needed at the facilities. And at that time, I think a lot more damage was actually done to communities out there. So this was actually said. So we've worked hard. We've got a lot of very dedicated providers. We've worked hard into making sure that the women get to know out there. And the SRJC was also helpful, because when we saw that the data was going down, we were also communicating to say, please help us out. Make people out there know that services are available and they can actually come in and access our services. And what Sis Dudu and Sharon also mentioned, already when our services were not ailing because of COVID, we had challenges in servicing sex workers and service other minority groups like the LGBTI and so on. So it's actually even more, it's actually worse now, because they can't gain access, and if they don't know anybody within that facility, it's even more challenging. And on the issues of gender-based violence, it's even worse. I was actually asked by one of the facilities in our district last week to actually come and sensitize the staff in the facility to manage clients who are experiencing gender-based violence. And it was actually a shock, because it's only at that time that we realized that the healthcare providers didn't even know where to refer people that are coming into facilities that are experiencing gender-based violence. They didn't know safe houses. They didn't know where to go. And in a way, I am a little bit saying thankful to COVID, because a whole lot of things are highlighted. We're realizing now more the gaps that we've had and things that people had to deal with, and they actually we're actually learning from that, because it was before, it was someone else's problem, and suddenly when people come in, they realize that we actually need to act. So that has been a challenge. And the fact that we are having this COVID issue, I think nobody even takes note of the fact that our contraceptive stocks are not going up, the fact that people are not coming to access their medication. I must say, in the primary healthcare sector in our district, we've worked very, very hard, even though it was very challenging. We've tried to deliver some of the medication, but because people are coming from far and wide, and because people couldn't move, it was a challenge. We even, in our district, we even had an Uber service that was delivering medication, but then we come to the place and then we don't find the person, and now we have all these packets of medication of people who are not accessing the medication, because they still have that message that they shouldn't access the facilities because of the scare of being infected or spreading the COVID virus. So I must say that COVID has really, really changed a lot. But despite that, we're still working very, very hard. And it's very hard on the healthcare providers, because everybody is scared, and suddenly we realize that our healthcare providers have been so burdened. We have a lot that are having comorbidities that are actually suffering, and that we have had facilities having to close. In one area, we had a facility closing, and while we were actually doing testing and screening on of COVID at the whole, it used to pain me to see the women and children outside that clinic, knowing that they cannot access family planning or even immunizations to the mothers and the children. So that was actually sad, and there was nothing that could be done because the healthcare providers were infected with COVID. Facilities had to be closed. They had to be decontaminated. So COVID has actually turned our world upside down. But I must say, despite all that, we have a lot of hardworking people, a lot of people who care. And now it's almost like it's only now that people are listening when we say to them, hey, SRH needs to be looked into. But in all the, at the moment we have the facilities that I've been monitoring, I've got four in our district that the abortion providers there are very, very good. They administer family planning. They are there. I mentor them and I go to them. So we're getting somewhere, but very little, but all I know is that we've got a lot more women out there, and it's probably going to strike us when this disaster is over that a lot more damage has been done because our facilities are practically empty. People have got other priorities now. People need food. People need work. People are scared also to contract the virus. So throughout all the lockdowns, there's been challenges and people actually having other priorities instead of having to come in, forgetting that it's actually causing more harm. So we're probably going to have a lot more children that are going to be abandoned, a lot more women that are going to go backstreet and have abortions, a lot more diseases, for example, TB and HIV, because people are not accessing, people are not adhering to their medications anymore. And the fact that because we are decanting our services and we are having a lot more healthcare providers that have comorbidities, some of them are actually working at home. So we have less hands that can actually offer SRH and abortion services in our facilities.
Thanks so much, Sister Judy. That gives a real sense of and texture what's happening at the coalface. There's a question in the chat box. Khaladi, I don't know if you can access the chat box. Kerry Callinan, a journalist, is asking, do women in Rustenburg have to wait until the second week of September to get abortions? What if they're over the legal limit? I don't think that's exactly what you were saying, but maybe if you can clarify. Khaladi?
Yeah, so what I'm saying with that is that basically what we are having more women requesting termination of pregnancy, and in terms of booking patients, we book according to priority now. If you're about 18, 19 weeks, definitely before the end of next week, the procedure will be done. But then we get those that come and then they are 14 weeks today. And then it means we can still, I see it as causing even harm by delaying it. We can delay it for another 2 weeks before actually doing the procedure and prioritizing the one that is 18, 19 weeks. So with the second trimesters, our priority is always the ones between 18 and 20 weeks. It's a priority within that very same week that you've come. But if it's less, around 13, 14 weeks, yes, we are booking patients. Some are booked up till the second week of September, as I mentioned.
Thanks. Thanks. Are you covered, Kerry?
Yes, thanks. I wrote in the chat box. Thanks very much.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Great. Yes. I wanted to ask folks, the floor is now open. Are there any other questions that people have? I see that there are lots of folks that have joined us from outside South Africa. Kristen, it's great to see you from the States. What questions do folks have? What more would you like to hear from Dudu, from Sharon, from Khaladi, and from Judy? So maybe if I can ask some more questions to the panelists now. Dudu, can you tell us a little bit more about sex workers' challenges in accessing very particular sexual and reproductive health services? I know this is something that we have worked on. And given criminalization, what about access to condoms? What about access to contraceptives? Do they have access to all options? What about access to abortions? Dudu, can you talk to that, please?
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Marianne. I will speak before the lockdown and COVID, before it comes in as a disaster in South Africa. Sexual reproductive health issues was not even recognized that is a one of the challenges of the sex workers even before. The most, I think also resources that our, the, and organization and projects that was available with sex workers, it was most HIV and treatment and TB, but there was not really specific project was looking it in a sexual reproductive health. Mm-hmm. After we formalize ourselves and then we're starting to looking at what really we need. The first issue of the services that was a challenge is to access abortion. And also the second one that mothers identify that it was an issue to get contraception. And then after that, it was mental health. And then the fourth one was we were looking at in terms of the treatment of like children who's affected by HIV. So in sexual reproductive health, we find that it was very challenging. It was not easy for sex workers like to go to the hospital or go to clinic to find like a abortion. But since that SWET has Mothers for the Future, it's very easy for them to just call us and call helpline and ask us for services like, I need to do this, I want to do this, I decide to do this, I make choice for that. Then we're able to support, but we're not only supporting them to make sure that they get the services, but we also supporting, because even after they getting the services, we have checkups that, how are you doing? Are you okay? So how do we get those? But through partners, we partner with sexual reproductive health. We also partner with Sister Judy that make us our work easier for sex workers to make sure that they're doing it. And remember that through that of the criminalization, the stigma and discrimination make a lot sex workers to not access services because of they are scared or they know in their clinic. So we move. Me and Sister Judy, we able to make sure and Sexual Reproductive Justice College, and we make sure that if she's staying in Khayelitsha, she can able to move to doing it in Victoria. So it's a very challenging, it's a very challenge to get those services. But for now, through partners, they access those services. But during the lockdown, I don't want to lie, and I'll speak very the truth. I've been contacting Sister Judy also one day. There was someone that wanted to help, to get help, but Sister Judy respond very quick, and then we support her, and she did, and it was successful. What I can say to people, everyone who attending this webinar, is to really looking to everyone to come up, to come forward with any services like legal services, sexual reproductive services, under health services, that they must come forward for to help and assist sex workers anytime, because sex workers is still a challenge to assist those services.
Thanks, Dudu. Lucy, can you talk to your question, please?
Hi, yes, thank you. Sorry, I wrote it down, but I just thank you for your amazing presentations. Start my video. Oh, I don't look very well.
Lucy, can you just introduce yourself, sorry, and say where you're from, by the way?
Okay. Well, I'm Lucy, and I am a sexual and reproductive health nurse, and I work with Doctors Without Borders, mainly looking at the healthcare access for key populations in the Southern Africa region. I'm a colleague of Khaladi, who was just speaking there. Amazing that he got to connect, because connection is not so easy sometimes. Anyway, I was listening very carefully to Judy, where she was saying that knowing the provider of services in the community is key. And people, you know, providers go down with COVID or may not have COVID, but, you know, have to do a bit of sort of isolation or quarantine. And then people stop accessing the service, either because they know that that service provider, the face, you know, the friendly service provider, is there or not there. And so I'm wondering if any of you have already or are already using alternative ways of keeping on the engagement of people to or tracking people so that they stay in safety, you know, that they're still, I don't know, accessing their medication, or if they need a refill, so telemedicine or telecounseling, all those sort of services, if you are doing these services during the times of COVID. That's my question. Thank you. Is it clear?
Yes, Luz.
I guess the question then is to Judy and Khaladi. Khaladi, you kind of answered it to say that you're going to be starting to do some telemedicine options, and I think that that's fantastic. MSI started to do that as well, and I see Dr. Dlamini's on from MSI been piloting that. This is really an area of development, and are folks talking about it in the province? How are we going to move ahead? Because this clearly is the next step. WHO is, you know, basically talking about self-managed abortions.
Yeah, I could hear Dudu also talking there, because I think that maybe the sort of knowing the face of your supporter, provider, it could be somebody like a nurse, but it also could be a lay cadre who knows how to provide services. So I wonder, that's it, if who has begun to use these mechanisms to ensure that people continue being safe, their health, safety. Yeah.
Can I just add on to something there?
Please do.
Yeah, it's just something that in Rustenburg, actually, and also in Mpumalanga around MLO, which I've noticed, like, there are private practitioners that are offering self-managed abortions, like professional doctors. I've heard and I've seen, and I know of a few, that when women come and request for a safe abortion, they tell them, even if I've seen cases where women about, she was 16 weeks, and then the doctor explained the pain medication to her, this is how you take it. When you're at home, you're expelled. This is how you're going to dispose of the fetus. If you can't, you bring it back to the practice, and then he's going to go dispose of it. So it's something which is being practiced, but people are not really open up about it. That's one thing that I've noted about it.
Okay. Can you hear me? Hello?
Go for it, Judy.
Oh, okay. During this period, we've actually used quite a bit of our community healthcare workers, and the department has also employed community healthcare worker trainer. So I think for the future it'll work. We just need people at the top to get to this understanding. I think in my district, people are still our decision policy makers are still a bit wary about telemedicine, because at the moment we are having big challenges with having to even trace people that have COVID to get them into isolation places, because we can't find them in their on their cell phones, and we get into areas like Masipumelele where there are no addresses. I've been there personally. We walk all day and we cannot access the people. So I think if in communities that can manage the telemedicine, it'll actually work very well, because those that actually have access to telephones and so on, they can actually understand, we can communicate with them, so it becomes a little bit easier. But I must say that in the Western Cape, the department has actually used quite a bit of the community healthcare workers. We have a lot of NPOs that have come on board. We have a lot of retired nurses that are actually helping us. And it's actually been lovely working with them, because they know these communities, they know where to go. And we've actually even used the same community healthcare workers to actually be a link between us and the community. So I think in the future we could work that route, because the communities trust the community care workers that are with them. Therefore, we can communicate with them, and if we actually do educate them and give them the rules and link them up with us, I think it'll actually work, because accessing in facilities is actually quite a bit of a challenge. So that'll actually be okay. But the biggest challenge that we are having before COVID and even now, we do lack support in SRH and abortion services. So we still need policymakers to be full on. We don't need just a handful of people standing in the forefront, because we are not decision makers. We have a lot of facilities now that are not functional, and nobody's actually pushing anybody for these services to run. And yet we have people that are trained, that have the facilities, that have the medication, but people have their own reasons why they cannot actually offer the services. So we still need a lot of manpower, or people that can actually make sure that people are accountable, they offer the services that are actually supposed to be offered at the facilities.
Thanks, Judy. I see that Carrie's got a question around some work that she's doing on obstetric violence. Carrie, do you want to talk to that?
Thanks, Marion. I put a long story in the chat. Basically, I work for Open Democracy, and starting my video, and we've just done a whole lot of research into how women are treated, particularly during childbirth. And we found that in 45 countries, a whole lot of really traumatic experiences that women had, including deaths in particularly Uganda and Kenya, people who were either turned away from facilities, or they couldn't get transport because of lockdown regulations. But we didn't find much in South Africa, because not much is being reported. And it might be linked to what Sister Judy is saying about people just not, these things are happening, but nobody's telling us. So if there are any such stories that people have or could share with me confidentially and so on, I'd be very keen to follow up on any kinds of violations of patients' rights or things. So, sexual and reproductive health services becoming really difficult for women to access during this time. Thanks.
Thanks, Kerry. Do we have any folks from the Eastern Cape? Because the story that was covered in the the Daily Maverick about a week ago about from Livingston Hospital showing the kind of collapse of maternity services. If there's any other folks on the ground that could speak to that or have any further information, so Kerry could expand on that. I want to talk a little bit more about the options of telemedicine, and just to let folks know that the Sexual and Reproductive Justice Coalition has just joined the MAMA Network, which is a regional international group based in a partnership coming out of Tika in Kenya. And we're really excited to be looking forward to hosting training and looking at starting an abortion hotline with some of the partners within the SRJC. And particularly looking at this as a moment of opportunity to really look through what that might mean as a feminist network. So this is very exciting. And if you want to be part of that, please do let us know. I'm very glad that we've got Francina from Nairobi on the call, who we're going to be working with in setting this up. Welcome, Francina. I want to ask if there are any other questions or issues that folks want to talk to. But before folks come forward with that, Sharon, I wanted to ask if you could perhaps take us back to that really awful time when the Strandfontein camp was happening, and many folks that you serve were moved there, and your nurses had to go and care and kind of work out what was going on. I don't know if that's been recorded or if that those stories have been told. The horrendous stories of the Strandfontein camp generally are known, but I don't know in particular about what that has meant for queer unhoused folks. Thanks, Sharon.
So it was a terrible, I don't even want to call it an experiment. It was just, perhaps the province thought they were doing the right thing, but it landed up being a disaster. So for those who are not from the country or from the province, what happened was that the Western Cape rounded up unhoused people and took them to a camp which resembles a really large dumping ground, I guess one could call it, and it was unbelievable to think that they would have thought that this was a good idea in the face of all the messaging that was coming out early on, when none of us knew really what we were dealing with. But where all the messaging was around physical distancing, and you had hundreds of people right on top of each other. So in the initial phases, our nurse in particular was on the ground and at the site all the time, because people were taken there with, you know, some had no medication, some had a couple of days of medication, and because all of the focus was just on COVID, there was very little attention paid to things like diabetes or ART or medicine for hypertension. And so initially we had no trouble with our nurse being able to be there and have access and to report back to partner organizations that had service users there in the camp. So we, you know, the continuum of care, because I think that's really important, particularly for marginalized clients, that we know where people are and how to reach them. And then it broke in the media, I guess about 2 weeks in, it broke in the media what the circumstances in the camp were like. And then our nurse, who was apparently highly recognizable by a red bucky, was then stopped from going into the camp. And the thinking initially was that they wanted to keep any NPOs people on the ground who were working out of the site, so that I guess it limited reporting. So although she was physically stopped from going in, we could maintain contact with service users of ours that were in the camp via phone and topping up their data to allow a contact to be maintained with them and to ascertain what the needs were and to set up a way in which we could meet at the fence and drop medication or drop additional nutrition for those who needed that. But it was a truly horrific experience for those in the camp. And yes, some of those stories will most certainly be documented and are being documented currently, because I think those were the worst of times. And I think there are great lessons that can be learned about that during periods of COVID. And then if we have a look at what's happening in Kenya at the moment on Block 13 at Kakuma Camp with LGBTI refugees, it's a similar context, and it's horrible. It was horrible. It remains horrible. And I think for a lot of people, really a traumatic time. And I just want to say something else about that, because it's easy to call people homeless, which is why I prefer the term unhoused, because people, and Dudu will attest to this too, many people who we serve have lived in communities together for years, some 15, 20 years in the same place. And so although they live out in the open and unhoused and in pieces of felt and under bridges, they don't consider themselves homeless. They consider that their homes. And so when they move to spaces like this, and this often happens even without COVID, is that the city will decide they're doing a cleanup and they'll just move everybody, and away goes all, you know, the little that you had is taken, and so is your medication is gone, and your ID and everything else. So it makes people exceptionally vulnerable. And it certainly did in this time and continues to do, although the levels have eased a little and people have been able to move around. When people couldn't move around, for example, there was little thought that went into the fact that the nearest tap may have been 3 kilometers away. And how do you take your medication if you can't walk? Because if you walked, you got a fine. So we're also sitting with people who have got notices to appear in court, and one is actually coming up before the end of this week, or I think tomorrow, of R1,000 fine for you know, going, moving around, and that's just within a short distance. And so I can't, you know, all the repercussions that have come from this and how systems that are already under incredible strain are going to cope with having to hear cases on people who moved 500 meters or a kilometer to go and get something, and that don't have R1,000, they don't even have R10. So, you know, it's all these other repercussions that are going to have a knock-on effect and overload already overloaded systems like hospitals, like day clinics, and like courts. Yeah.
Thanks, Sharon. I'm sorry, I missed this. Mbali Baduza had a question for Dudu. Mbali, do you want to talk to criminalization and the protective duties? Mbali, would you like to ask your question, or should I just read it to Dudu? In the light of criminalization of sex work, what is the relationship between law enforcement, protective duties, and sex workers? I can imagine it is not good at all. Dudu?
It's not, thank you very much, Marianne. It's not good at all. It's not good at all. There is no any relationship between both, because Even now, during this lockdown, we have sex workers who died in one of the sex workers died in police station, and we don't have, there is no one who's responsible for that, not yet even a case going forward for that. And no, and there is sex workers who died in Durban because of the police. They were after them, they following the car, and they wanna, then they happening car accident. There is sex workers was arrested during the campaign of the GBV Enough is Enough in Durban. They were targeted and they put them in the van, and there were 14 in the one van. And those things, it shows that really there is no any relationship between for them. But also there is still more of violation that is happening of sex workers, that as they're experiencing from SARS, from Metropolis, even now in level, we are in level 3, but sex workers who are just going out, they are still experiencing that. About the result of the sex workers who are dying, to update, is that just that there is no perpetrators that already arrested for that. So I think that this is it's not a new stories, but it's a story that's been happening under criminalization since then, when they're using these laws who label sex workers as criminals. So criminalization is put sex workers more vulnerable into reporting cases, more cases, and taking, and Department of Justice not taking serious of the criminalization of sex work. So during this disaster time, for sex workers, really put them in high risk and put them more and more and more into the dangerous. But there is no ways that if now we, after this lockdown, or after if we survive in this, we can let it go like that. We need to get more support to advocate for decriminalization of sex work in South Africa, because it's the only way that sex workers can able to exercise their rights as full citizens and able to recognize as human beings, and also able to recognize by labor laws, so that they can able to looking at how they going to able to benefit in South Africa, because sex workers are really a hard workers, but of which other people they do not looking at and take it serious. Not only sex workers, but there is sex workers who are LGBTQI plus person who doing sex work plus LGBTQI. As specific, all of the marginalized group, we need to really look at the advocacy work and pushing for them to make sure that everyone is accessing human rights and justice in South Africa.
Thank you so much, Guru, for talking to that. We're coming to the end. We've got about 10 minutes left. And so what I wanted to do, if there are no more questions, I'm going to ask the panelists to each give some closing remarks looking forward. COVID is these circumstances are going to be with us for a while. People talk about the new normal, but I guess what has happened during COVID is COVID has amplified. It's put a magnifying lens to the desperate inequalities and devastation of our social determinants of health, and in particular, the injustices that populations face in relation to their sexual and reproductive health, or their sexual identity and gender identities. So I've just heard from Lucy that Khaladi had to go because a patient in the next door room has just expelled and he needs to go and help her. So that clearly talks to the need, the backlog that is happening, and how providers are essentially still working at kind of 5:30 in providing a continuum of care. So perhaps if we could start off with with Sharon, and then with Dudu, and then with Judy. Basically, looking forward in the next year, what are you hoping for? What do you want people to know? What should we be advocating for? One of the key messages that I've heard is for us to support you in advocating for our policy providers and policy makers and decision makers to be very clear on implementation and putting in place programmatic ways that make your life easier in implementing services. So over to you, Sharon, and then there you go.
So in closing, yes, I mean, what you've just said is so true, and that is the inequalities. It's not to say, and we all know, they existed and were glaring before, and now I look like I'm sitting in the dark. They are absolutely magnified tenfold now during this period. And so we will continue, as we have always done, to place LGBTI and others at the center of what should be a people-centered health system, but really isn't. And the point that Sister Judy made and others have made, and I'm glad really heartened to hear. But honestly speaking, when I tell you that for us, the work with Sister Judy and with others is critical for us. And Doctors Without Borders, Lucy also asked this and touched on this, is that when you know somebody specific like a Sister Judy, like a Sister Yvette Andrews, that you can call and say, I've got a patient, we're outside, she's terribly ill, they're not letting us in, that we can contact. And only then do you get responses. What about people who are sitting in Rustenburg or sitting in other areas who don't have that contact? But that's how we've always had to work, is with key people within different facilities in order to access services. So we will continue going on in the future to continue to build relationships, to continue to have strong partnerships, even with one or two people within facilities or services who we know the people that we serve are safe in their hands, and that people can continue to get care. And in the meantime, we still advocate for inclusive and services for all people. Thank you.
Thanks, Sharon. Over to you, Dudu.
Thank you. I will just asking and pleasing that we will love everyone to support the DCRIM campaign, vocal in your advocacy work, including the decriminalization of sex workers and issues of marginalized groups. Also understanding this, the sex workers issues and marginalized groups, but also contribute as you can in the organization that's working with marginalized group. But if also you also interested to work with the marginalized group, please engage with the organization who work with marginalized groups. The last final word that I can say is please come forward, because without partnership, we will never, ever able to support the marginalized group. But through partnership, we did able also to offer some of the services, even though it's not those services available in all these partnership are not available in all provinces, but through partnership, we did able to support each other. I please also ask to come forward with providing such health services, providing legal services, psychosocial services, all those resources we need it, all these services, we need it so that we can able to support the poor and the vulnerable groups. I really thank you all the partners that they help and support, even we're not reaching under, because it's very deep, we cannot able to reach everyone, but at least we're trying, we'll keep on trying, and we also keep on doing advocacy work and support these marginalized groups. Thank you.
Thanks, Dudu. And finally, Sister Judy.
I'd just like to say that we really, really, this is my plea, we need to work together in collaboration with partners and grow this movement, because to me, it seems like we will not go anywhere if we do not have the support. Because within the Department of Health, which is so huge, which services quite a lot of people, it's very difficult when you only have a handful of people that can fight. It's okay for me to fight in my district, but what about the woman that lives in Atlantis? What about the woman that lives, or anybody that needs the services in Stellenbosch? It's difficult. If she can't access services in my district, then it becomes a problem. So I feel that we need partners to actually push the department to become aware that we need to service vulnerable communities. We need to service communities out there with the rightful services that they need. SRH, gender-based violence, it's actually a real problem because we cannot reach everybody. I'm overwhelmed all the time on my phone with pleas from all over, but I cannot intervene everywhere, especially when it is not within my district. So this is my biggest plea, because when we fight within the department, we are being told, Judy, you need to remember that getting involved in SRH and gender-based violence and abortion services is not the only core function of the department. We have chronic diseases, we have mental health and so on. But they actually forget that these people that are dealing with are also being affected by mental health. They also have chronic diseases. And obviously they still need SRH services. They need services for STIs. We also need to embrace the vulnerable communities like the LGBTIQ, especially the young ones who exist in every district. And another thing, the reason why I'm pleading for partners to particularly get involved, it saddens me when I get to facilities where a healthcare provider don't even know that we have Triangle Project that exists. They don't know where are the safe houses. They don't know where to refer people. And I feel so helpless, because there's only so much that you can do. There's only so many people that you can reach, that you can make aware that outside the department, we have these services. You can refer, you can partner. It's not only a Sister Judy that can speak to so-and-so outside, but we actually just need to get voices out there to get everybody to know that we can work with outside partners to actually reach all of our communities. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And it's 5:30. And in bringing everything to a close, we had about 51 folks joining us. Thank you very much from lots of from all over the place. Fantastic to see colleagues from the continent, from Ghana, Abina, it's lovely to see you, and members also in the States that have moved on. This grouping is thinking of having a series of webinars. So if there are any particular questions or issues that you'd like to explore, or if you just would love to, I mean, I can sit and listen to Dudu and Sharon and Judy for, you know, listen to their experiences more and more and more. If there are particular issues that you'd like to listen to, if you'd like us to continue this, to do some more webinars, we are also thinking of perhaps producing some podcasts. inbox us, let us know. But otherwise, I think it's time for a good cup of tea. And thanks again for everybody's partnership. I see we've got a huge amount of advocacy to do and a lot of work in pushing our governments to put things together. Thanks again. Bye-bye.